If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
Now I know in this day of mass customization, there's like a lot of capability to customize within the production process. But, you know, as a developer, you want to simplify. In fact, my saying is complexity is the enemy of profit.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Hey, Scott, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here, Sam. Appreciate the invite.
Hey, man, the pleasure's all mine. Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad glad that you took the time to come on today. This will be great. If you can, just give our listeners a quick bio on who you are.
Yeah, so I'm the founder and CEO of your Pacific Group, Scott Chopin, based in Southern California. You know, first a little bit about me. I'm a 35-year career developer, both professionally and entrepreneurially. I'm married to my wife, Becky. We have three kids, 19, 17, and 13. I think this year we'll celebrate our 23rd year of being married and 28 years together. So we're starting to be married longer than we were old when we met.
That's cool.
But I founded Urban Pacific Group of Companies, and basically what we are is we're a real estate development company. And I talked about being a career developer because it's really, in my mind, in the last few years, very, very differentiated from being an investor. And, you know, I think everybody, I think, has a better collective understanding of what an investor is. But a developer basically creates brand new assets from nothing, you could say, would be the shorthand, find an empty piece of land or underutilized. And that's what we do. So I founded the company 21 years ago. Now, actually, this last March was our 21st year of operations. I spent a few years working for other companies, have a family background in real estate development. My dad and my uncle were both in the business, so I got a chance to be exposed to it when I was young. You know, sort of did a couple years of working out in industry prior to going to school at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. Graduated with a finance degree from there, and then worked in these for these professional companies, which would include some names that you'd recognize. So one of the companies I worked for is now called KB Home. It used to be called Kaufman and Broad in the old days. And I actually worked for a division of theirs that built a brand new apartment buildings as a corporate offer. Like they didn't rent them to the public. I mean, we rented them to the public, but it wasn't like their offer. It was just an investment model to facilitate, you know, corporate earnings, happened to be in the affordable housing domain. So I did that purposely to really get a rapid, deep training in being a real estate developer, working, you know, for professional companies. And then after about 5 years doing that, I launched Urban Pacific, which is now 21 years later. So that's me in a nutshell.
That's super cool. That is super cool. And you guys focus now on what?
Yeah, great question. So we've always been urban infill housing developers, right? Would be the way I would describe it generically. Urban infill meaning we're in the city, we're not on the peripheral edge or in green fields, they call it, where, you know, there's new land never been developed. We're always inside the city, right? Infill, finding sites that are vacant or underutilized inside the city fabric. And we really predominantly have done apartment development. So new construction, development of apartment, rental housing assets, always new construction. And then about 5 years ago, we, in 2016, 2017, there was an interesting little flat spot in the market. So we'd had this wave of projects that had come through post 2008 recession. So like from 2011 onwards, you know, it's time to go back in development, you know, markets. A lot of distressed assets, deals that were, you could be bought for very cheaply, land, half-built buildings. And by about 2016, a lot of that had been like flushed out of the market, right? Those deals had been bought and developed. We did a handful ourselves. And in 2017, you know, it was when the real big wave of new construction projects was starting to come on board. All the big guys were getting in, the Trammell Crows and the Amleys and Holland Partners and all those guys. And so we looked at it as a big wave, and no problem competing, but but we choose not to compete is the way I say it, Sam. So we started to look around for doing a different product, and that's where workforce housing appeared for us. And from my days at Kaufman & Broad, I had a background in affordable housing. So we focused on what we call now the urban townhouse product. We didn't call it that then, but we created the model of a multiple bedroom, multi-generational, family-centric rental housing unit. Now, interestingly enough, in that 5 years, the whole idea of the build-to-rent marketplace has basically been created, right? Nobody was doing that, you know, even a couple of years ago, people weren't calling it that. Call it single-family rental, build-to-rent. This sort of have different connotations. But the idea is to build a product type that's apartment rental housing, but is in a different format. And so Urban Townhouse is a three-story townhouse rental housing product with 5 bedrooms and 4 bathrooms is what makes it really unique. It's a townhouse, so 3 levels, you live with your own family, right? 5 bedrooms, 4 bathrooms. So it really is focused on people that are, you know, have multi-generational families, 2-car garage, in-unit laundry. So the way we say it and have been for a long time is purposely designed and built to rent, but lives like a house. And I coined that term probably 4 years ago. And that really is the build to rent market, right? It's like a house, but you rent it, right? It's differentiated because it's maybe detached or attached the way we do it. And then we call it workforce housing because in California, really what it does is it serves working class families. So they make really decent incomes, not enough to afford to necessarily to buy a house, or maybe they don't choose to buy a house. They can't find a brand new rental housing unit because the predominance of new housing is studio one, you know, small urban infill. That's not their gig. They're families. They have kids. They have, you know, grandparents and in-laws that live with them. So our product really was to facilitate meeting the demand of those working class families. That's why we call it workforce housing, because these are literally families that work. They have multiple earners in the household. They share incomes and expenses across the family group, a concept we call economic sharing. So that, I, you know, let me stop there and make sure I let you get some questions in here.
No,
but that's you know, workforce housing, at least our version of it.
No, I love that. I mean, there's so many questions I would have, and where to start and ask the intelligent one is the hard part, I guess. So it's an interesting demographic, I guess, that you're serving with 5 beds and 4 baths. Like right. You said, that's multi-generational.
Mm-hmm.
You think that's region specific, or is that something that you see happening kind of across the U.S.?
Well, yeah, it really, so a few, couple different answers that appear to me as you ask that question. That's a great question. One, I think it really is all driven more culturally,
mm-hmm.
right? So those cultures or those demographics that live in a family-centric orientation, which if you look at it globally, that's how most families live. Over right. In Asia, in India, in South America, living multi-generationally is like that is how people live. In fact, if they didn't live that way, it would be odd to them, right? They would think there was something wrong if, you know, their grandparents wouldn't live with them, right?
Right.
So really where we focus on is those areas that have the demographics that would, you know, generate demand, right? And for us in Southern California, it's predominantly we're focused on Hispanic families. All the time as we're traveling, talking with new cities and different people, city council members, you know, city staff, all the time we're like, oh, wow, this is like my family. Like, great that you're bringing this product to the marketplace. And it's just, it's never been available. I mean, yeah, houses are available. Like, people could rent houses and have multiple bedrooms. But interestingly enough, people who are like, you know, their life is organized around renting, right? That's the market that they're in. They don't necessarily think of themselves as house renters. When we first started UTH, I used to teach the leasing teams, like, look, all else being equal, families would always rent a house if they could, right? White picket fence, backyard, American dream. But it's interesting, as we've developed this over the last 5 years, I've stopped saying that, because basically we get people who come to rent in our units, like, let's say we're doing leasing tours or open houses on Saturdays, and we'll go, what else are you looking at? You know, are you looking at houses? And they're like, never, right? Like, we didn't even, in fact, what they're doing is they're going on rental websites like, you know, apartments.com or Zillow is actually a big source of leasing traffic for our units. And they're looking for an apartment. And then we show up and they go, 5 bedrooms and 4 bathrooms in a rental unit? Really? Wow, I didn't know that existed. And so all of a sudden, the opportunity for them to like live coherently with their multi-generational lifestyle, all of a sudden expands, right? Like we give them a new space of possibility to live, meaning mom and dad, adult kids, younger kids, in-laws, grandparents. And so we often get the story where like these families are starting to recombine, right? Like, you know, one family in our recent project, it was a mom and two daughters. They all work. Mom's like an entrepreneur. The two daughters work, and our project that they leased that was like centrally located to the job. So that was why they picked it. And then they're like in discussion about bringing other family members from other parts of the state or even out of state and say, come live with us. Because now all of a sudden they can start to share that those economics with each other. In fact, our metric right now is we're renting at about $740 per bedroom. That's the rental rate, you know, divided by the number of bedrooms, five bedrooms. And, you know, this is in a market where easily most, you know, one and two bedroom units that are brand new, you're at least $1,000, even upwards of, you know, $1,500. So generally on a per bedroom basis, which is an unusual way to like look at the rental market, you know, we're at like half the rate of what the market is.
Wow. That's super cool. Yeah. I mean, and like you said, on a per bedroom basis, the cost is lower, but even the more heads that you can get in there, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the per person cost has to go down.
Yeah. And I'll offer, like a lot of people imagine, they go, wow, five bedrooms, like cities do this a lot. They're like, five bedrooms, you're going to have like, you know, 18 people in that unit. And we just don't have that. What we have is the average is 4 to 6 people in a unit. The pandemic has really accelerated our business plan dramatically, as it has done with other types of business. And what's advanced for us is, you know, in recessionary times, families, they what I call recombine. They'll come together to be act offensively economically, again, to maybe share incomes and expenses even more closely, right? To bear the burden of unemployment and in fact, multi-generational families have the lowest poverty rate in those income categories. It's a study Pew Research did, but also the work from home model has blown up. I mean, it's like, you know, we'll have families that will live in three bedrooms and use the other two bedrooms as their work from home space. Or we've had people that, you know, we had one family, it was like two college students and a mom, and they were going to dedicate a room. This was like their study room. And not everybody has the capability to, you know, do that economically. But it's just interesting that we've like we created this unit to serve a specific category of demographic, you know, multi-gen families, middle income. But it's like ended up that the trends of the pandemic really, you know, accelerated and advantaged, you know, bigger units. And last point, in what I call urbanized suburbs. So we're not in the city center, right? Downtown, whatever. We're not on the far, you know, periphery of, you know, deeply suburban new housing. We're sort of in that in-between space, what I call urbanized suburbs. So they're suburban in format, right? Like, you know, single family homes, some commercial, older, like vast sections of Southern California are classically this, like our people know us for sprawl, although our population density is like one of the highest in the United States. But it's like an older suburb that's sort of the commercialized and built out a little bit. But if you drive through it, you would know it's like a suburban, you know, format from a development perspective.
What's been your tenant retention on these units?
You know, after 5 years, we're probably about 2 years into, like, you know, like some of the early projects, because it takes about 2 to 3 years to get like a project going, build it, and then rent it out. We have had really almost 100% retention. And in fact, I'm glad to say that we were very fortunate that we had almost no rent collection issues at all. In fact, you know, just normal stuff of, you know, late rent payments, you know, a couple of days, that kind of things, the normal friction that you would have. And then I'll offer, we've leased two recent projects, one from September through December of last year, which to me, like, as I observed it, that period of 2020 was the most difficult leasing period I've ever seen in my career. Like the pandemic, lockdown, unemployment, people were scared just generally. We ended up leasing this project in Orange County at about $5 a month, which is, you know, actually above market, at least in comparison to other new housing projects that I was tracking leasing on. And then more recently, we have a project in a city called Montebello, and we're actually doing about seven per month on leasing velocities, which is not quite double the market. Usually 4 4 month is like a good metric, depending on, you know, what, at least in Los Angeles and the way we track it. And these, mind you, are all over pro forma rents. So we're $200 to $500 over pro forma rents and with a very accelerated leasing schedule. So, you know, we just good timing, right? Right product, right time. Couldn't have anticipated the pandemic and, you know, work from home. Like, who could have known that? But we were answering a question of these multi-gen middle-income families. And that's really our focus, right? Like, that's our like philosophical, like ethical focus of like helping families find a great place to live. That's our focus.
That's super cool. Let's talk numbers on this. How were you able to build a product that then rents for $750 a door when competing products $1,500 a door?
Yeah. So a few different things. So the initial answer is it's several things all combined together in one offer that make it happen. So there's not one like, you know, silver bullet, I call it, like do this and it all works. So first and foremost, it's the format of the unit. So in other words, the 5-bedroom, 4-bath units, about 1,750 square feet, three-story townhouse. So we're building a simple product, right? It's on grade construction, 3-story stick frame, like, you know, we do nice finishes, you know, a plank flooring, quartz countertops, like nice cabinets. So we're definitely meeting the market standard for apartments, but we're just really making it as simple as possible to build. So that's one, the format is simple to build versus higher density podiums or high rise, right? Those get more complicated, right? So the second is we build the same unit over and over again. So this is true production housing. In fact, this is the first time in my career that we've been able to repeat the unit type over and over and over again. You know, and for some people, it sounds a little boring, but there's a reason why all the home builders in the United States pick a plan or two or three, and then they build all that. Now I know in this day of mass customization, there's like a lot of capability to customize within the production process. But, you know, as a developer, you want to simplify. In fact, my saying is complexity is the enemy of profits. The more complicated you make any part of the deal, the land, the financing, the entitlements, the build, the design, the rental, you know, any of those are going to like slow your timeline down, cost you more money, produce more mistakes and more breakdowns. So the more you can get rid of that friction and complexity in the process, the just drops to the bottom line. So, okay. So we talked about the unit type. We talked about the production, same unit over and over again. We're generally buying land in middle market communities. So we're not buying high-end land. We're not in the worst neighborhoods either. We're in these urbanized suburbs, which tend to be sort of a little beat up, to be quite honest with you. And so what that helps is that helps on our land costs, right? Like we're buying land in neighborhoods that a lot of other developers aren't. In fact, we instruct our brokers, don't send us anything too nice because we won't pay the price that, you know, one needs. So like in LA, there's a market called Echo Park, Silver Lake Echo Park. It's in, you know, like north of downtown LA, generally people could think of it. And that's really like a hot market. A lot of millennial, really, you know, high income millennials are buying townhouse units. And so these townhouse, you know, for sale developers, they can pay a lot for land. They can pay maybe like a couple hundred thousand a door. We don't, our economic model doesn't sustain that, right? So we need really to be paying about $100,000 a door, maybe even less if we can find it. And all the time I get colleagues, man, I can't find land $100,000 a door. Like it's impossible, they say. I can't, you know, it won't happen. I go, hey, look, we've sustained a model for 5 years. We have, you know, probably 12 projects in the pipeline right now. We're able to do it. It's just so different in the way that we're going to neighborhoods that people would normally avoid. Like not because they're scared. They just go, oh, like I can't sell a $800,000 townhouse there, or I can't rent a, you know, $5, $4 a foot, you know, luxury rental product. It just doesn't work. And that's fine. For us, that reduces competition. So reduced competition means reduced land prices. Okay. The next one is we really, as a practical matter, only ever want to buy sites that have the zoning already in place. So although we do on a case-by-case basis do what, you know, an entitlement process where you have to rezone it and do what's called a general plan amendment or other entitlement actions, we generally try to avoid those. Or if we do take them on, we want them to be non-discretionary, meaning we don't want the city council to have the ability to say yes or no just because neighbors are pissed or they don't like it, or, you know, there's too many people in a 5-bedroom unit, or there's not a parking, or it's too expensive. I mean, any discretion that they would have. California, we're the worst state out of every state in the United States for housing production and our housing prices reflected. So when you put all those together, right, that makes the model. And then at the end of the day, I would say the most important thing out of that is that we're producing relatively high whole dollar rents. So our units rent for about $3,500 to $3,700 a month for that five bedroom unit, which would sound high if, you know, people are, you know, if you're in Tennessee or you're in Texas or wherever, you know, people are like, wow, that's like really expensive. Except when you do it on the per bedroom basis at 740, all of a sudden you start to understand the economic sharing metrics. Like, oh, I can, you know, in a two bedroom, I'm paying $1,000 per bedroom. But if I go over here, I can be 740. And then even on a per square foot basis, we're on average 30 to 50% on a per square foot basis below market also. So the high whole dollar rents generate a good income stream relative to the cost that it costs to build it, right? That's the development model. So how much income can you produce versus how many dollars it took to build it, to produce it, right? That's a NOI to cost ratio is what we call that in the development business. And we just need to produce the highest possible NOI at the lowest possible cost. And so all these things start to add together to make that formula work. Now, we're all under pressure, right? Lumber costs is the highest I've ever seen in my career. We're certainly, all of us are experiencing inflation of commodities, of food and gas and lumber and all those kind of things. So we're having to manage that, right? Like we're not bulletproof to that, but that's all developers are. And all investors have to deal with that inflation of asset values and their cost of carpet and cabinets, you know, if you're doing a value add deal. So we're all in this, you know, sort of rising and falling inflationary market. Fortunately, it appears that asset values and rents are also rising, not in concert with those commodities, but, you know, maybe commodities are doing this and values are doing this, and we're sort of doing this back and forth. We've had, as I spoke before, we've had some relatively provable, you know, increases in pro forma rents when we go to actual market. In fact, we're going to sell two of our properties here shortly, so we'll actually be getting a gut check on what the, you know, asset values are. But, you know, we know they're up generally just from our market research.
Yeah, and that was going to be my last question before we jump here into the final four is, what's your guys' typical exit?
So typically it's not to sell. So we, in the early phases of the Urban Townhouse UTH program, we by design built several projects as an experiment, what I call the demonstration phase. In other words, we wanted to prove this model worked, because in all practical terms, nobody had ever done five bedroom, four bathrooms at scale. Like there's, you know, little people, you know, little developers here and there doing the stuff, you know, sort of one-off projects or maybe small scale stuff at volume. But we basically took this idea of five bedroom, four baths and put it at scale, meaning number of projects and size of projects. And so we're the largest producer of this unit type, probably in the United States, if I could, you know, drill down into the stats. So we sold those projects to prove the values, right? We needed to have a test case in the market, like a case study, and go, look, these things really sell at this value. And we did that. And then about 2.5 years ago, we started to see signals in the market that the economic cycle was getting like stale, right? It was getting like, we're getting near the end of like, we're at a peak, you know, rents were up, and, you know, the economy was doing really good. But really the signal for us, Sam, was like when people started to say, their narrative was, we're in the longest economic expansion in U.S. history, which was like 10 years. And we actually passed that and then ran smack into 2020. It just caused us to basically orient differently now, where we're basically going to hold all the projects that we develop as a long-term defensive strategy against downturns. And that turned out to be exactly the right move, because as we've gone through it, you know, in March through June of last year, like we didn't know what was happening. In fact, we took a little rest, a little, you know, 3 or 4 month waiting period to make sure that the market wasn't going to do something totally crazy. I mean, it was crazy enough as it was. It turned out to be that the work from home environment was, we could see that accelerating. Like, you know, we're getting calls from roommates and, hey, we're all moving from different cities and we're going to live in Orange County. And we like, your 500 units perfect for us. So we saw that accelerate. So that basically changed us into a long-term hold rental housing developer and owner. In fact, we're in the process of raising capital on our first real estate equity fund that will be wholly dedicated to financing, you know, the supplying the equity to now 16 projects in the pipeline for that fund. 12 are active. And then we've got a few, you know, sort of getting ready to go on. And so that puts us completely in a long-term hold. And the final answer for me is, you know, I want to own everything that we build forever, even beyond what the capital markets will want, because, you know, not every investor will, and most don't want to go into an asset forever, and rightly so. The two projects I mentioned to sell were just, they're not going to fit in the fund. They're not the right size, really. They're too small for the fund. So we're going to sell those assets just because the fund isn't going to be a fit for them. But also, here's another chance to test the market and see what values are. And in fact, the numbers have come back way above what we had been selling some assets in, you know, 2019, 2020. So the inflationary effect of all the stimulus money appears to be showing up in the multifamily markets. We've made our way through all the rent collection issues. And yes, we have eviction moratoriums. And yes, we're going to have to go through a period of, you know, eviction, which I'm not looking forward to. You know, we won't have any issues because we don't have any people that are not paying the rent at this point in time. And we see it could even accelerate people wanting to move into our unit as they come together out of other units that could come into our, but philosophically, just the idea of, you know, people being under pressure, you know, from a, you know, rent in arrears issue is not a happy story. So we just need to try to move our way through that period of time as quickly as we can. We're still underdeveloped. We're still undersupplied. You know, housing prices are showing that really all over the United States.
Right. Yeah. And it's, I mean, you've got many compelling reasons to hold on to them. One, why sell if you don't have to?
Plus, we're looking at inflation, I think, the next several years, and hard assets with fixed rate debt are exactly where you want to be. In fact, you know, multifamily to me is, I mean, any income producing real estate, you know, is good for that. If you can get fixed debt and own it and collect in inflated dollars and sell inflated dollars in the future, but you got to make sure it's a product type that will last, right? Like you continue to, you know, if you're an office owner 2 years ago, you were probably feeling good, and now office is under pressure. So workforce housing to me is so deeply undersupplied. I mean, in California, I don't know that we'll ever like literally catch up to the ultimate demand. I hope maybe we will, but you know, historically the evidence doesn't suggest that. So it's a good, you know, supply constrained space.
I love it. I love it. Scott, this was fascinating. Thanks for taking the time to come on today. Let's jump here into the final four. The first question is this.
Sure.
What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
So two things show up. You know, I think as I look at my own career and how I was when I was young in the real estate business and how I am now over the last several years, really is to build your networks around you. And it sounds so like such passe advice. And I don't mean networking and, you know, glad handing and handing your card. I mean real powerful networks of people that you work with. So for investors, it would be people finding you deals, banks that you work with, investors, of course, right? But colleagues that are in the industry who, hey, I'm in, you know, you're in Memphis, I'm in LA, let's compare, you know, how we see markets. And I've like developed over the last, since 2012, the most powerful set of people around me. Those are people that work for us, team members, outside advisors. And really the main philosophy that's come out of that, Sam, is that just to not have the feeling that like it's all on me. I mean, it is all on me as the entrepreneur, and I'm not meaning responsibility, but I'm meaning like in the old days, if I want to learn some new technology, I would go like do it myself. I'd, you know, watch videos and do this and learn it. And this. Now I'm like, who can I find who knows that thing really good and hire them? Right. And stop screwing around and like go fast, right? Yeah, I could learn it and you could learn it. And, you know, we all could learn it. Great. But how much time and money do we forego by spending that time? I know really at the end of the day, my value's best in raising capital and producing new deals and new strategies. Anything that takes me away from that is, you know, it's like eroding profits, if you will. And so the networks, more and more, I just keep going to the, you know, who's the best in this category? Let's go get them. You know, whether it be real estate stuff, you know, we have a whole social media platform. I'm like, I don't care anymore. Like, let's go find the best that we can afford, right? Sometimes there's a affordability question for the best, but we try to, you know, always, you know, pair up and hire and team with the best that we can find at any given time.
Right. No, that's great. I love that. Question number two is this: when it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you are doing to stay on top of your game?
Yeah. So I am a, like a adherent, like 100% to like continuous competitive learning. And what I mean, you know, continuous, you get that, what that means. Competitive learning is learning in a way that has you be able to effectively produce new business, new ways to do business, you know, how to, you know, people to hire, networks in a way that like has you advance amongst your competitors in whatever domain that could be. It could be your colleagues in the business. But the reality right now with computers and the internet, and, you know, like Zoom would be an example. Everybody knows that, like, we went from, you know, no one using Zoom to like everybody's using Zoom, right? In the span of 3-6 months, whatever it took, you know, if you're not somebody who uses Zoom now, like people go, oh, well, but that's a problem, dude. I need to talk with you, you know, face to face as much at least as you can through a computer. So the ability to coordinate and cooperate globally, you know, through computers and the internet and things like Zoom has advanced so rapidly that I think a lot of people aren't necessarily in recognition. So what all that means is my competitive learning is in that space. So I learn with, you know, one group particularly called the Aji Network up in the Bay Area. And the guy who created that is a guy named Toby Hecht. And his whole philosophy is around working what we call the fourth industrial revolution, or IR4. And that's basically coordinating and cooperating with other human beings globally using the computers and the internet, right? If you think about it, computers have really, in the mainstream way, been around since the 50s, although they predated that. But in a way that you could have a computer in your house and you know, everybody's got their phones. And we have now like the most powerful computers in our hands that allows you to find somebody. You know, we talked about networks. I mean, my team is mostly virtual. Some are here locally to do construction stuff that we need done locally. But I have several people that, you know, work in, you know, Florida. I have folks who work overseas, right? And again, going for the best and, you know, trying to like advance and accelerate the team. The more I can work competitively in using those systems, technologies, human capital, the more I'm going to accelerate my business. So I've been studying with them since 2012, and I basically will do it for the rest of my career, if not life.
That's awesome. Question number three is this: when it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
Yeah. So, you know, the interesting thing about this UTH model is, you know, we didn't necessarily start out thinking that it was going to be a workforce housing model for families. But given my background in affordable housing, after about a year, that finally appeared to me. I go, oh, this is who we're serving. These families is who we're serving. So although it's not we want to do well by doing good, right? Like you've heard people say that. And so our product has a social impact characteristic, right? And that's the thing, like, you know, we're here to produce profitable projects and produce returns to investors and make profits to take care of our families as a company and myself as the CEO. At the end of the day, I mean, we've gone totally all in on this workforce housing model. And that is predominantly related to, it's just such a great thing to help these families live coherently with their family lifestyle, right? It's, you know, I mean, I would suggest probably in today's environment, politically and otherwise, the family unit isn't necessarily like culturally what we talk about enough and what we aspire to. And so I feel best about the fact that I can basically produce a housing unit that helps families live affordably and brings them together in ways that they didn't have the capability to do before. So for me, that's probably one of the best things that we do in this development model is help families.
Yeah, that's absolutely cool and an absolute need. You should be proud of that. Scott, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
I would encourage people to go to our website, www.urbanpacific.com. While they're there, hit the sign up button and get on our Saturday email list. And what you'll get is our, you know, thinking and articles that we read every Saturday. We give you a grouping of articles and economic signals, market trends, you know, new trends and whatever. I mean, it's open book. It's technology. It's blockchain, it's market trends, it's the economic cycle. And so I would sign up for that. And then if people want to go to our investor education section, and we have a ton of stuff in there just about apartments and apartment development. And for any of your investors that are thinking about, you know, transitioning into investing or even sponsors doing their own development deals, we have a lot of data in there about like that gap between investment and development, which is sort of an interesting space. There's a lot of data in there. So I would encourage, and our contact page, you can get a hold of any of us at the company via that.
That's awesome. Scott, thank you so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Yeah, good to see you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen,
If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.